Hi, this is Paul Vanderhyde from Vandermill Cider, from Spring Lake, Michigan, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 125. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are speaking with Paul Vanderhyde, the owner of Vandermill LLC. This is a cidery that has two locations in Michigan. And Paul is also on the chair of the United States Association of Cider Makers. In fact, he is the new president, taking over the spot that Mike Beck of Uncle John's Hard Cider held for a number of years. We'll be speaking to Paul about the association and Vandermill Ciders, which are both modern and traditional, and how this cidery, which began selling cider in 2008, now has not one, but two locations in the state. How did he do it, and what has he learned along the way? We'll be getting to Paul's chat in just a moment, but first, some news from Ciderville. On the last episode, number 123, Big Fish Cider Company's Kurt Billingsley, who is the founder and chief cider maker there, and Sarah Simon Collins, who is titled as the orchardist, but I kind of see her as an all-around whiz, too. That chat was really great, and I have to say, the fact that they brought so many amazing ciders to that conversation, really tasty ciders, really made that recording even more fun than one can imagine. So I really hope that you get a chance to have their ciders. If you recall, last week on that episode, I was also toting the cider tour that is heading to Normandy. And I was talking about 6 degrees of separation. The idea that I know, you know, somebody out there, if it's not you, someone out there who would love to go on a cider tour to Normandy. And we know this is like thinking way out of the box here, Ciderville, because people don't even have it in their minds to go on a cider tour. I mean, why the heck do that? I know I'm speaking to the choir here because you and I both love cider immensely. We see the value of it. We know that in this podcast, we've featured so many different conversations, and yet each one is really unique. You want to hang out with the folks who are on the podcast to see their facilities, to taste cider on location. There's nothing like it. In fact, I am going to be heading to Michigan very shortly for the Glen Cap, which is the Great Lakes International Cider and Perry competition taking place in May, coming right up in 2018. I'll have the privilege of meeting a lot of makers. I'm going to go on a cider tour to be able to go to some of the locations. So this week's podcast with Paul Vanderhyde, I'm going to get to go to Vandermill and be on site. Now, I had a bottle of the Chapman Cider, which is Vandermill's heritage cider, last night, and it tasted good, no doubt about it. But having some of that on-site in Michigan, there's nothing like it. That is a difference of importing a cider, whether it's from one state to another, versus being at the location, if it's an orchard base or even if it's a modern cidery. It just changes the whole experience 100%+. So I could go on and on about that, but I know it because I have felt it, and I know that some of you have too. So going back to last week, I was talking about 6 degrees of separation, that idea that you know someone. So I'm going to call this quest to get folks signed up on this tour, the 6 degrees of cider. And let me give you a little couple tidbits here to think about. When you talk about degrees and bricks, 6 degrees is, in terms of specific gravity, is 1.02 or 3% alcohol by volume. So what the heck am I talking about there? If you aren't a maker, you don't know what any of this means. Certainly, sometimes I don't even think about it. I just make cider, and maybe I check the specific gravity. Typically, I just taste the blend of the cider. Does it taste sweet enough before it's fermented that I'm guessing there's, you know, enough sugar in there? I'm good to go. If you want to be more technical, you check what is called the Brix or the specific gravity, and that tells you what that unfermented juice by volume is going to be turned into alcohol. So the way juice gets fermented, essentially the yeast there, whether you add a commercial yeast or what one might call a cultured yeast, or you just let that cider go wild, the yeast will start gobbling up the sugar, and in turn, that's fermenting and creating alcohol. And the cool thing about that is it happens with everything that has like sugar in it. You could ferment that to alcohol with the right kind of environment. So we hear two different terms. Brix is a term that's used often in the wine industry, and a lot of people say, hey, cider is wine. I like to separate it out, but I get what is being said there because the same kind of tools are being used. But we also use the term specific gravity, and that's where the confusion comes in. There are two different ways to describe that measurement. But anyways, regardless of all that, I'm calling this whole new push the 6 degrees of cider to bring people together. And I'm going to, again, put that out, that 6 degrees equals 3% alcohol by volume, which I have to admit, I like to drink a lot of that cider. You bring it up a little bit, you go 10 degrees Brix, and that equals 5.2% alcohol by volume. That's starting to get to be the place where, you know, I could have a glass. It's still sessionable, but if I want to drink that cider all day long, I'm going to have to watch out for myself here. You know, I don't want to be snoozing in the afternoon unless I've planned that ahead. 12 degree Brix equals 6.4% alcohol by volume. And then 15 degree Brix is 8.2%. And that 8.2%, that's kind of a kick yourself in the butt kind of cider there. It could be for me. I'm only going to be able to maybe have one, maybe two, you know, good glasses of cider there before I'm going to say, no, that's about it for me. So that's kind of fun. Just thinking in terms of Brix. And if I convert that to 6 degrees of separation, then what I'm really looking at is asking you to share the story that there is a cider tour heading to Normandy, France, the last week of September, 2018. It is still open. Definitely the early bird special ends April 30th, but this cider tour is still going to be going out, and I'm going to be keep on pushing it at 6 degrees of cider. And I really want to encourage you to join in on this 6 degrees of cider and sharing the Totally Cider Tour heading to Normandy, France, heading out the last week of September 2018. You can find the links and the information on this here episode 125 or just a Google totallycider.com. A box of cider came in from Wisconsin this past week. Came in from Alan Hyland, who is a cider maker. Well, I guess we should call him a winemaker because he works at Door Peninsula Winery, which is based in Door County, Wisconsin. So if you think about Wisconsin, it is on the border of Canada. Across to the east is Michigan. And there's an area called like Sturgeon Bay and, of course, Door County, which has this rich heritage because not only did I receive 3 bottles of cider, but I also received a video called Cherryland. It talks about the terrain of this area, how good it was for growing apples and cherries, and a bit of the history. So I'm not going to tell you too much because I suspect that in time I will be having Door Peninsula Winery on this podcast because they have a new feature thanks to Alan, who's been an avid cider maker. They have new products of cider. Let me tell you a little bit about what I received. I received a cherry mimosa, and that's because this region is renowned for its cherries. We always think of Michigan cherries, which are excellent. Well, this area had smaller, almost like dwarf apple tree cherry sizes. And because of the depression and all that, the area got hit, but they are still producing amazing cherries. I also received a heritage cider made with apples from trees that were pre-prohibition in that area. That is a new twist on what folks are calling heritage cider in the U.S. They're not necessarily apples coming in from Europe that are classic cider apples there, but folks are saying, hey, you know, these apples have been in the U.S. for a long time. They might be considered culinary, but they're also heritage. And I believe Paul Vanderhyde also is speaking on that too. So I received the cherry mimosa, the heritage cider, and a modern cider. Modern cider is made a little bit quicker turnaround. And I haven't opened them yet, Alan. I'm super stoked that you sent them. I made a little video, a thank you for Alan. I'm going to post it up on the Cider Chat YouTube channel. And I'll try to link it into the show notes here also. And they're also making a Perry. A Perry, right? So this is really to the credit of Door Peninsula Winery that they were realizing, hey, you know, we should be doing apples too. We had the same terrain as New York State, believe it or not. That was pretty interesting. Learned that in the video. The Perry itself is being made with Asian pears. So Wisconsin, it's got it going on in cider way up north. Of course, there are some cider makers there, but I'm really excited to open that. I'll let you know what I think about those ciders coming up in a future chat. While we're on the same note of raining cider from the sky, there was another box of cider that arrived at my door. This one came in from Michigan, actually Fenville, Michigan, and that's a cidery called Virtue. They have a rosé that came out. It's in cans, and it's just a beautiful presentation in the can. I mean, it's really stunning. I did a little unboxing video of that. You have to check that out. It's going to be on the YouTube channel. And I want to say I had really high hopes for this, just having had some of Virtue's other ciders that they kind of do both their specialty ciders. But what I'm impressed about the cidery is that they're making larger quantity ciders, more not necessarily specialty ciders. And this one is described as a proper farmhouse cider. And a little bit of the write-up says that it's also barrel aged too. So that caught my, you know, what was going on there? French oak barrels. Who knew, right? Well, I opened it. And I just want to say my only disappointment is that you only sent me 2 cans. I love it. This is a good rosé. I've had a number of them, and I want to say this is a good rosé. And I want to say that just because you sent it to me, because the other boxes that were sent to me, I'm not talking about. But this one, I really like. It's like quenchable and too easy to go down. Really pretty color too, that nice red. It's made with all Michigan apples. So we got a little bit of a Midwest theme, and that'll move us into our chat next with a Michigan cidery, and that's going to be Vandermill coming right up. This main chat with Paul Vanderhyde was pre-recorded at CiderCon 2018. Paul and I sat down for a wee bit there and were able to catch up on what is happening with this, what many folks consider a kind of a mega cidery. So I was really excited to have that opportunity to chat with him, and I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So now let's all grab that glass and join this chat once again with Paul Vanderhyde of Vandermill in both Spring Lake, Michigan, and Grand Rapids. We begin this conversation speaking about the United States Association of Cider Makers, which Paul has been on the board for the past 3 years. And at CiderCon 2018, he was elected as the president of the association.
We obviously are learning here, and we all know just from it, those of us in the business know what kind of roller coaster it's been being in the cider industry. And I think, you know, this year, the feeling of the conference is different than it ever has been before. I feel, you know, in the past, there's been occasional disagreement and conflict. And, you know, I think everyone was a bit struggling with what is the vision for this very diverse group of cider makers. What can we all contribute that contributes to all of us? I think USACM moving forward from this year is going to be far more impactful than it ever has been in really raising awareness and helping represent the entire category. And I think that, of course, it's made up of the people in it. And I think that vision is becoming a bit more clear on how we're all working towards the same goal. And we talk about it often where cider comes from apples, and apples are good. And if we can't agree on the apples, then apples come from trees, and trees are good. So let's just keep moving with that sentiment, and we'll all win, hopefully.
Yeah, well said. I think it's an organization that, or I keep on calling it organization, association that is very, I feel the cohesiveness this year in CiderCon. That's what Paul's talking about for folks out there in Ciderville. This is based in Baltimore this year, and last year it took place in Chicago. And we're talking in the first day of February in 2018 at CiderCon. You're doing that work and helping move it forward. You also have this cidery in Michigan, and you have two locations now. That's kind of new, isn't it?
Yeah, it's relatively new. kind of like the rest of the industry, we've been riding a roller coaster of our original location in Spring Lake. We started 10 years ago, primarily focused on sweet cider and donuts and that fall time experience, which is so typical in Michigan and throughout the Midwest.
As a family,
as a family friendly business, and business is tough, and we're always looking for, you know, new ways to pay back the bank. And we started working with fermenting cider right back when we opened in 2006, and then received our license in 2008. And then fermented cider was really what people were gravitating towards. And then we jumped on the rocket with a lot of other cider makers around the country, and just had a real strain on our facility and our capacity on how do we make more cider. And that was really kind of the key for a few years, which is what led us to look for a location that would provide us an opportunity to grow without having to change the way we do things every single year. We started actually with an addition to our building out in Spring Lake. It was 3,000 square feet, and I couldn't believe how big that was. And I figured this was going to be the 5-year plan for sure. And then about 6 months later, we were hauling things out into the parking lot just to get work done. So we moved into a far bigger facility in Grand Rapids, about 40,000 square feet. Added a large tap room and restaurant. And it's really taken us about the last 2 years to figure all that out. The restaurant business is a tough one.
That's what I was going to say. A lot of people get into that. It's like, that's could take a lot of your time. How's that going for you?
It's been challenging. It's a busy marketplace where we are for hospitality. A lot of new restaurants. And, when we're here at CiderCon and you're around your peers, you think everybody knows about cider. And then when you come back to reality, you realize that there's a lot of hard work to, you know, continue to spread the message. So it's been very challenging and admittedly a bit distracting to our cider business.
When did that site in Grand Rapids open?
We've been open there 2 years now, which already feels like a lifetime ago.
I'm sure it does, yeah.
Even though it took us some time, we've now feel like we're in a good place. We've done what we've accomplished in that we have both capacity in fermentation and packaging and more space than what we can conceivably ever use. So it's inspiring and gives me a renewed optimism being here at CiderCon again and being with our peers that are so excited about the category.
So do you have any advice for other makers out there that are thinking about doing that? well, if it was beer, it would be called a brew pub. But if it's a cidery, is there a name at this point for a location that's serving and also has the restaurant piece? Have you toyed with that?
No. We struggled with that because even the word cidery is something that I think is a natural. When people think about it, they think winery, brewery, and we get asked, is it a cidery? Mm-hmm. Beyond that, we're happy if they get there. But we do put restaurant on the side, just so that on the sign, just so people know that it's a full experience.
So any advice though in that 2 years for those folks who are thinking like, I want to have not only a tasting room but a restaurant too?
Yeah, it of course depends on the market that people are in and what's around them and what their consumer base likes. I have, in this industry, had the luxury of eating very well and drinking very well, and we know that those two things go hand in hand with cider. So, I have some friends in the brewing industry that started out with that very basic pub food years and years ago, and then have realized, wait a minute, we might want to do something a little bit more elevated because we're out selling high quality beverage. We want to make sure that the whole experience matches that. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, I've really tried to shoot for the moon on quality of food, which I think is great, and it's a good match for cider, but it makes an already difficult restaurant business more difficult and more expensive. Mm-hmm. And, I think in the long run, I'll be happy that we stuck with that, but hindsight, keeping it simple would have really, it would have been a much less distraction to what is our core business, and that is making cider. But along the way, we've worked with some great people and are proud of what we're doing. It just becomes more challenging the higher quality you want to go with food.
The more demanding it gets in many ways, to keep that register up there, no doubt. Yeah, and I think that's pretty typical from what I've seen in the craft beer scene. You have the really fine brewers coming in, and now the restaurant's taking a lot of your time. So probably go into that pretty calculated, and then a lot of room for flexibility.
Yeah, and it depends on experience of the cider operator too. I mean, restaurant experience certainly would help.
Do you have any?
No, well, I've got 5 years of education and hard knocks, but other than that, I didn't previously.
Yeah. So, is the cider that you make? Do you consider yourself a modern cidery or traditional or both?
I consider us both. We have grown quite a bit, and in the cider making world, we often get referred to as as one of the bigger cider makers, which, when I look at some of the breweries around me, I think, yeah, gosh, we're still so small. But it wasn't all that long ago where we were just piling totes up in the corner of the room and fermenting with an ale yeast because we couldn't control temperature, and having all of the same growing struggles with fermenting the beverage that we actually want to present to people. Now that we've been able to invest more and control our processes better, it was really the consumer that drove one part of our business into saying, hey, I really like that product, so I want to experience the same thing the next time I drink it, which is difficult from an education perspective to the consumer because it's hard to do. There's only so much control that we can have over what Mother Nature gives us with the juice.
All right.
So really early on, we decided to take both paths of heritage, larger format ciders, as well as more of the modern ciders that we can and keg. And I think that's served us well. We've got a partnership with a local grower, somebody we've been doing business with for 10 years. 2 years ago now, put in a considerable block of cider fruit for us. Nice. We're doing...
How did you convince them to do that? Because that would be a good little tip for people.
Well, ever since I got into cider world, there's been this in any kind of farm trade show or within the cider industry, there was this problem, and that was cider makers are saying, boy, we really want these cider apples in Michigan and everywhere, I think. And the growers are saying, okay, well, what ones do you want? And we're saying, well, we don't really know because we've never used them before. And, you know, all we have is what we hear. You know, these are names only. And then, of course, the second question from the grower is, well, how are they going to grow here? And so what I've relied on, and there's a lot of research done, and I think research is great, but what ultimately got this project done for us was a great business partnership with our grower. And it took probably 4 years of me kind of saying, hey, you know, we really want this. And then 1 year, Dan Dietrich, our grower, says, well, I got a few trees in my backyard. We can graft some stuff over. And I'd kind of pound the table. I'd be like, no, it's going to be too late. You know, we need to do something. We need to do something bigger. And so then 4 years ago, he traveled out to Farnham Hill, and they clipped 30,000 pieces of budwood and put 13,000 trees, high density, over 20 acres in Michigan.
Sweet.
Yeah, and they're a large enough grower where they say to me, they're like, well, we've made bigger mistakes than this in the past if it doesn't work. And he said, how do you think it'll grow on high density? And I said, Dan, you're going to find out because nobody knows.
Yeah.
So that's been really exciting. This year was the first year that planting had cropped anything.
Wow. Wow.
So now we have these, you know, these bittersweets to play with. So it's we have as much of investment and passion for our heritage line of products as what we do our, you know, more modern products. Mm-hmm. So
okay. So just to catch Ciderville up, when he mentions Farnham Hill, that's based in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and we've had Steve Wood and Louisa Spencer, and they've been on the podcast. Let's talk a little bit about the difference between modern and heritage. So I know that you have some cans, and that would be typically the turnaround there is like a 4 to 6 week for cider, and then the heritage, how is that model set up?
As far as the timing,
yeah, of, for your timing of your
production,
yeah, and how it's packaged and all that.
Whenever you're strained on capacity, you always figure out how to make your product as good as what you can, and oftentimes as quickly as what is possible. And we've done a pretty good job of maintaining a high quality cider and speeding up that process.
Mm-hmm.
We right now have probably as much time in settling as what we do fermentation for our modern ciders.
Mm-hmm.
Our heritage ciders, we tend to ferment them a bit cooler, try to keep and retain as much of the aromatic and subtleties of the apple as possible.
Can you give us a little info on the temperature?
So normally we'll ferment at about 59 to 60 degrees.
Okay.
For our everyday products, and that fermentation is really only about 2 weeks. But then we have almost 3 weeks of settling after that.
This isn't the heritage products.
No.
Right, right.
And then our heritage ciders, we come pretty close to 10 degrees cooler than that, so mm-hmm. low 50s.
Okay.
It's a bit slower. It could be 3 to 4 week,
mm-hmm.
4 week plus mm-hmm. fermentation, about the same settling. And then usually since we have the juice, we like to try to do a lot of different things with it. So we'll put some in American oak. We'll, you know, keg some off right away. We use 750s for kind of the off-premise
mm-hmm.
Package.
Mm-hmm. Are those corked bottles or crown?
Crown
cap.
Yeah,
okay.
They're crown cap.
So that's a 750 mil bottle, what Paul's referring to, a glass bottle.
Yeah.
Nice presentation. And your distribution, where does the distribution go out to?
Yeah, so Michigan has a handful of states that touch it. one through the Upper Peninsula, which is Wisconsin. So we distribute there. We distribute in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. So right now we're just in the states that neighbor us. The lion's share of what we're selling is in Michigan and Chicago. Some of those other markets are a bit newer for us. And like I mentioned with, you know, our expansion into this new facility, you know, the restaurant was distracting, the new facility and moving production was distracting, and all of those things contributed to us doing less work than what we would have liked in some of those other markets.
Sure.
So again, now that we kind of have our feet on the ground with our new digs, we're going to, you know, look to really foster those neighboring states.
And would we be able to find your cider on draft anywhere other than your tasting rooms? There are draft accounts out there. And
yeah, we've done a really great job throughout Michigan and Chicago. We were early in the market for craft cider in Chicago. I think we're up to close to 500 bars in Chicago, close to 600 throughout Michigan. So and then less in those other states. So.
So you could seek it out, and probably there's a link, or you could contact the cidery and say, I'm coming through this area. Because Michigan is known as having that kind of wine trail, and I like a cider trail, too, because there's so many amazing cideries there. It's a large fruit-growing, cherry-growing region, and you integrate that into your ciders. Do you integrate that into your heritage ciders? Because I don't know much about your heritage ciders at all.
We haven't done anything other than apple besides pear. So we do a Perry as a part of our heritage series.
With Perry pears?
No, with Bartlett pears. There are no Perry pears in Michigan.
Okay. So, and that's part of your heritage, working with the Bartlett.
Yeah, we had a debate yesterday, well, and the night before, as we were looking at the CCP, the Certified Cider Professional Program, which I'm a part of here through USACM, on, you know, what is a heritage apple? And in the beginning, Jonathan was listed as a culinary apple, and I said, well, wait a minute, Jonathan's been in this country for over 150 years. Bartlett's were the first pears to come to the United States from France. Why wouldn't those be considered heritage? So, like everything in this industry, we're trying to fit, you know, trying to identify and define what we're all doing and what should and shouldn't be, and that can be challenging sometimes.
Well, certainly the Bartlett pear is a challenging pear to work with.
Very.
It's not high in tannins at all. It's kind of a bulbous kind of pear, so it gets a little, you know, from the inside out kind of going. How do you work with that? Because I'm sure a lot of people's ears just peaked up, just like mine, having worked with Bartlett too, not having a lot of luck.
Yeah, we actually have it here. I'll see if I can.
Oh, nice,
we had it at
nice.
Cider Share last night. I'll
nice.
See if I can get you a bottle to try it.
Yeah.
It has more challenges than what culinary apples have. In the fact that there is very little, if no tannin. I mean, I can't say no tannin, but very little tannin. Pears, Bartlett's add another level of complexity in that the pH is pretty high.
Very high.
So we often talk about when we do our fermentation with for our Perry, we are all over that tank all the time. I mean, it is something that can turn on us in no time.
How do you manage that pH? So it gets come out, and we're talking, what do you typically, do you know, offhand?
We use malic or right out of the gate with the juice.
Right as when it's like being crushed, do you pour it on? Or it could go acetic really quickly.
It can. We do it right when we load the tank. So when the juice is still cold and fresh, we adjust that pH. Usually down to, I mean, it'll come in sometimes at 3.8, and we like to get it down to maybe 3.5.
3.5, okay.
Which, unless you want to sleep next to the tank and smelling it every minute.
Many have done.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that because that's kind of like somebody's dream.
Yeah. And then also, you know, a good nutrient program. And, you know, it's... People don't, I think outside of the cider industry, don't understand how, it's a hard beverage to just pull out the cookbook. You rely so much with apples, and I would say even more pears, on the sensory of the cider maker, mm-hmm. With their nose and with their taste. And mm-hmm. Last year, our Perry, we ended up with more pear juice than what we had thought we were going to have. And so we fermented it. It fermented clean. It was great. We kegged some off. We bottled off what we wanted. And then we thought, boy, we have this other juice. What are we going to do with it? We put some in wood. And then we ended up with, this is a painful number, we ended up with probably 2,000 gallons that sat in that tank for, I don't know, maybe only an extra 2 to 3 weeks. And I was doing a tour of the cidery, and I went off the sample valve, and the thing had turned acetic. Oh. And I thought, oh my goodness.
Ooh.
And pears are expensive in Michigan. Yeah. So,
what would have made that different there, do you think, this not have it go acetic?
I think if we had packaged it, we also use a pretty regimented sulfite program. We don't use a lot, but at the right times. And we like to use about 25 parts per million at package, which I think would have helped that situation if we had just gotten it out of the tank and put
now
it in the
would
bottle.
You be filtering that, Perry?
Yes,
you would be.
Yeah,
and it's not a pear cider.
No,
it's a Perry, meaning that it's only pear.
Yep, that's
okay.
Right.
Okay. Wow.
Yep. And now the silver lining there is that we had this, you know, now acetic Perry and 2,000 gallons of it. And I'm thinking, well, great, I just blew tens of thousands of dollars. But fortunately, we have a nice partner in Grand Rapids that is a very successful small distillery. So we said, hey, how about we have you guys, you know, distill this pear for us, and we don't want to put any more money into it, so how about we give you half the pear juice if you give us the other half back in spirits? Which ended up being a very exciting thing for both of us, because once distilled, you know, the
even with the acetic acid, so what can one expect if they do have a pear that's gone kind of crazy and it's gone acetic? What is the product that comes out of that distillation?
We actually, and this is on their... They're the experts on distillate, and I wouldn't even get near calling myself an expert on on distilling. But what they have done is it's actually been sitting in stainless, because they say that with a product like that, they like to have it age on stainless as distillate for, I think they want it in for at least 6 weeks. And I'm not exactly sure what that does, and maybe nothing. You'll have to ask a distiller, I guess.
maybe it settles down or drops down or something.
Yeah, I mean, we're all familiar, I think, with, or those of us that are familiar with wine and cider, that, you know, bottle shock is a thing, and, you know, sometimes it takes beverage a little bit of time
to
mellow out.
Yeah. But this wasn't bottled. This is in a large.
Oh yeah, this is just
container.
Sitting right now.
Yeah,
we did get a little taste off of it, and it's it was quite surprising at just how much pear can come through, and how much you can really see back to the fruit.
So I'm still kind of wrapping my mind around what that would taste like. It's what, and what do you call that? That it's gone acetic, and then you distill it, and you get a spirit out of it. What is the overtures that?
And I don't think the acetic part would make much of a difference. When
I
say
acetic, it is.
That's just it. When I say it went acetic, I'm not talking about
vinegar.
Okay. I'm not talking about burning your throat.
Just a wee bit. Okay.
Too much for us to put in a package and sell as our Perry.
Yeah.
It's those types of mistakes that we've made a lot of, and sometimes there's a silver lining. It's certain we would have no story to tell if we just dumped it down the drain, other than how much money we wasted.
Yeah,
so
that's your story. Very interesting.
Yeah.
The malic acid, you stop fermentation via filtration for your ciders, the Heritage.
No.
You don't use filtration at all.
No. Well, no, we filter our Heritage. We do not stop fermentation. We go straight
all
to dryness.
Yep. So classically for your heritage ciders, are those a year bottle conditioning, or what's the timeline there?
We force carbonate.
Okay.
And we usually do one fermentation of Perry per year with our Chapman's blend, which is one of our ciders. We've done two different fermentations. We'll do one kind of in the late fall, and then just to kind of spread the
Chapman's
burden of
blend.
Yeah.
Harkening back to Johnny Appleseed.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then again, with our relationship with our grower, who also has invested in atmospheric controlled storage, we've been able to do a second fermentation of our Chapman's blend in early to late spring.
Nice.
Which is kind of nice to be able to separate that out and
mm-hmm.
not tie
mm-hmm.
up too much cash all at once.
Right, right. You got to keep it moving for
yeah.
sure. So are all the heritages sparkling?
Yes.
You don't do any still?
No, not
right
now.
Is that because of just the palate that you're experiencing with the consumers?
Yeah, you know, quite frankly, the 750 milliliter bottle has increasingly become a hard package to sell. Again, when we started doing Chapman's mm-hmm. blend, mm-hmm. Cider was far less known even than mm-hmm. it is now.
Right.
And a still cider, you know, 6-7 years ago, you know, people didn't get it. They thought it all
it, yeah.
had needed to have
yeah.
bubbles.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, we would like to do a lot more within our Heritage Series. And now that we have Michigan Bittersweets, we've really spread that out a lot. So we froze a tote to do a ice cider, and we've done some wild ferment in barrels. We've done some wild ferment in stainless. So
right.
we're gonna see a expanding of our Heritage Series this next year, mostly because of the juice. And a still would be great too.
Mm-hmm.
It all takes a lot of work though when
right.
you have a. When you have a new product and you're in as the community of cider changes so much, I feel like I've changed packages on our Heritage Series
many times. Yeah,
and now
yeah.
we're looking to do it again.
Right, right.
And that all takes time. And
from a different 750 mil bottle, or
yeah, we're looking at going into a smaller bottle,
mm-hmm,
largely
yeah.
just to get the price point down to where we can move some more volume of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not so much. I mean, obviously, it's nice to move more volume because it's more business. But on the other side of it, we want more of this product in people's mouths.
And the more
approachable from a price point,
right.
from a package size that they can say, hey, you know, I don't mind spending,
mm-hmm.
you know, $7-$8 mm-hmm. bucks on a smaller bottle,
mm-hmm.
Versus, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, however high on a 750, you kind of remove a little bit of that impulse buy when you
yeah.
get into higher prices. So,
and people traveling through, you know, it's hard to pack a lot of 750 mil bottles. So it becomes a disadvantage for the cider drinker and in turn the cider maker.
That's right.
And I'm seeing packaging in France change quite a bit in that way. Making it more accommodating for the tourists coming through, that they can pick up bottles, often even 12-ounce bottles of cider, make it really easy for you to grab that and go. And we're talking some really nice cider, you know, you know, Kieve cider in a 12-ounce bottle. You know you're going to be able to sell that.
Right.
The weight alone is an obstacle.
Yeah.
I am seeing a shift in the market in that way. And why not? Why not have a heritage cider in a 12-ounce bottle? Then you could actually have like a 4-pack of 12-ounce bottles to go, and people are going to put that in their suitcase, and they're going to bring that home, and that is like becoming the Johnny Appleseeds of cider drinkers in that way.
Yeah, it's something we've considered as well. Like, why not have Chapman's blend in a 4-pack, 16-ounce, and put it at you know, $13-$14 bucks. It's unknown. The reason why I think we still want to have
it in a bottle. And we gave serious thought, and maybe still will at some point, put it in a can. Bottles present real nice. They, you know, they have the, they add an element of class to the beverage, obviously. And, you know, I think also from the retail perspective, retailers have a lot more patience for bottles sitting on the shelf. And what pull
but,
through.
But retailers do like cans because they can kind of stack it up.
Yep.
They're lightweight for their workers.
Yep.
I think the big thing about bottles is they've always been kind of seen as a little bit more sexier than cans.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a, they're svelte, you know, they look nice, the presentation piece, but they're heavy.
Yeah.
And they're breakable.
So. Yeah. And it's funny because they're a great package for a lot of reasons, but they're a terrible one also for other reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, we're trying to make great partnerships with retailers. My fear, and this is, you know, this is certainly only my opinion, is, well, for one, I don't think I could get, I think it would be difficult to get a retailer to stack a $14 a four-pack.
They do it for beers.
Yeah, I know.
They do it for beers. I think, so I want to encourage you, and I know I have a wave of folks out there in Ciderville saying, go for it, Paul, because,
I know it.
You know, like what did Nelson Mandela say? He said, it's only impossible until it's done.
Yeah.
And I think that's a truth around cider. And what I've seen over the, you know, span of time that I've been in cider is that it's constantly pushing up what was seen as impossible.
Yeah.
Nobody thought, you know, it'd be here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you are a savvy businessman and you had that bottom line. But I'm speaking from the voice of a non-commercial maker who wants to be able to show up at your spot. And I would prefer to drink a heritage cider out in the backcountry than, you know, just gulp cider.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's my preference, to drink that.
Right. And, you know, there may also be a wave of listeners saying, don't you dare talk about cans and cider. We're not that many years away from
they're where, a very open group of listeners.
Right. Well, that's good. We have
Ciderville's a happy campus.
Yeah. No, and I think what that, you know, it certainly is a testament to how the industry has grown in such a short period of time. And being open to new things and new ideas and package. And ultimately, we need to, you're right, we need to listen to the consumer. People are going to hate me if I go back to work and switch my mind, but you're awful convincing.
The thing about it, too, because, you know, I've been writing in the craft beer industry since 2003, and so I've seen that same wave happen with cans.
Yeah.
It was the same kind of, you know, a little bit of an elitist attitude to think that you can only put it in the glass.
Yeah.
And now you're getting rock solid beer in cans. It's fantastic.
Big barrel aged stouts.
Hello. And then there was the piece with the cans that folks might not know, so we should just talk about. They've really made the cans accessible for cider because it was a concern about the acid and all that. And so now that's not an issue.
Yeah.
And cider is something that you don't want to preserve there forever. If you're going to get one of Vandermill's ciders, a heritage cider, and it's in something that you want to put on your shelf for a while or in your cider cellar, you're going to get it in the bottle.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, and I think it's great. We've been in cans since 2012, so that was about back when beer was still struggling.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about cans at this conference in 2012, you know, might have gotten you chucked out the window.
Yeah.
So it's I think it's great. I think that is certainly what we noticed when we started canning our products, because in the beginning...
You were kind of the first ones to kind of can cider.
We were some of them.
I heard that kind of way, like, Vandermill's canning their ciders, oh my God, like in 16-ounce cans, right?
Yeah. And Uncle John's in Michigan, they came out with cans... Oh, maybe 6 months before we did also.
Yeah, it's
and
a big deal.
Our business at that time was we were doing modern ciders in 750 milliliter bottles.
Right.
90% of our business was draft. And part of it was obviously the wave of cider growth, the whole category.
Mm-hmm.
When we switched to cans, we're now closer to 65-70% cans. The volume...
Well,
when
that
you,
speaks volumes right it, there, right?
Right, pun intended. Wow. It really changed the game for our business in the amount of cider we had to produce, because it is a convenient package.
Yes, it is in a lot of ways. Well, so we will kind of stay on this story and see what comes about, because I could see those wheels turning.
Yeah, you might be able to take all the credit if you end up seeing Chapman's Blend in cans later
right,
in the year.
All right. Well, I will say this is a joint chit-chat conversation.
There you
know,
go.
That's what it is, really.
Yeah.
You know, where we're always kind of like working through these ideas. I think that's unique to the cider community at this stage. The palette is totally clean. You could create whatever you want, and that is very unique to this industry.
It is, and we've really noticed that, anybody can notice that as you look around the world to other cider producing regions that, frankly, drink a lot more cider than we do. I had the pleasure of going with a group of cider makers to Spain. Boy, it was almost 2-3 years ago now.
Mm, nice. Asturias or the Basque region?
Both, yeah.
Nice. So,
and,
love those.
And we obviously have here at CiderCon, we have an international crowd. And what we hear over and over from our friends across the pond is, while they have these great cider traditions and great products, there is a real element of jealousy that... you know, we get to do whatever we want.
Yes.
And
yeah,
I ran into Henry from S-Ball in Chicago, and we were out at a bar. It might have been CiderCon
last year.
It might have been last year.
A couple years.
And one of our products we call Totally Roasted. It's one of our most popular products, and it kind of came out of our roots as a...
Let's just talk about what Totally Roasted is, though, so
yeah.
They know what the full cider is.
Yep, so it came out of our roots of being a cider mill, sweet cider, donuts, weed, and it cinnamon roasted pecans and almonds, and it actually, it's not so flattering how we came up with it. I was at an account in Grand Rapids and was drinking cocktails with my customer, for probably a little too long in the afternoon, and I said, you know, we ought to just come up with some. Let's just do a new cider. They were a great account at the time, still are. We said, what should we do? And I thought, well, we sell cinnamon roasted pecans out at our cidery. I wonder what it would taste like to dump those in a cider. So we have one of those little, we still to this day have one of those little copper bowls that you might see in the mall that are sitting there candy roasting nuts. We take cinnamon roasted pecans and then we put them in big bags and chuck
them
in the fermenter.
Do you grind them up in like little pieces? You
know? We used to, and then I realized I'm paying so much money for these beautiful big pecans and then I'm smashing them.
Not good. Huh?
And not good. And so then we went back to our where we were buying them, and they say, well, we sort out pecan pieces. And I thought, well, that's perfect. Better surface area.
Yeah, yeah.
So we take pecan pieces and we kind of candy roast them, eight pounds at a time in this little copper bowl.
Wow!
And we use over 300 pounds of it a week now.
Oh my goodness! So how many people do you have managing the copper bowl? Is this like something that you put on like a little throne with a light beaming on it? The copper bowl.
There are guys at the cidery right now with their ears burning, because I'll guarantee you that little copper bowl is spinning as we speak.
Oh my goodness! It
makes the cidery smell delicious.
Yeah.
People come in and think it's fantastic. And, you know, kind of, gosh, I feel like it's the way things work sometimes, where the more work you put into something, the more people like it. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult
it's nice when it works that way.
It is.
Yeah.
So we've been looking for bigger bigger machines to do it. But I'm digressing a little bit, talking about Totally Roasted. But when I ran into Henry, he said to me, he said, "Paul, I don't know about pecans and cider." And I thought, you know, there's kind of the dichotomy classic between tradition, and I kind of smile and I said, we sell a lot of it. I mean, it's what a great opportunity for U.S. cider makers to throw a lot at the wall and see what they like, see what the customers like.
Yeah.
I would say after having this conversation that the members of the United States Association of Cider Makers who voted Paul in as president have chosen well, because you want someone who is broad-minded and can think out of the box and wants to have that conversation. So I really appreciated his time spent with me and just allowing me to kind of share my views. That's what you want from somebody in that position. And not only is he the president, but he also, again, owns Vandermill, which has those two locations, both in Spring Lakes and in Grand Rapids. You can find all the info for how to get there and where to go at the show notes for this here episode, number 125. And while we're talking about Grand Rapids, Michigan, do know that the Great Lakes International Cider and Perry Competition is coming up on May 16th through the 19th. And there is actually still time to get your ciders in. I had misread the date or the deadline for the cider entries. It's actually April 30th. So there's still time. You could get your either your homemade ciders or your commercial ciders into this competition. And I'm going to be judging, and I'm going to give everybody a gold medal. So, you know, what do you got to lose? There are two early bird specials that are closing on April 30th. One is for the Hoon Valley Midwinter Fest. That's going to take place on July 13th through the 15th in Tasmania. So get your tickets now. And the other one is for the Totally Cider Tour heading out to Normandy, France. So sign up now. Get registered so I don't have to keep on speaking all summer long about the 6 degrees of cider. Though I have no problem talking about Normandy 24/7. Check it out at totallycider.com. You can follow my shenanigans on social media. On Twitter, I am at CiderChat. On Instagram, it's at CiderChat, Ciderville. And there's also a CiderChat Facebook page, which is open to everyone. Some really cool people joining up on that page. Almost to 1,000 people, which is really phenomenal for a podcast like this with such a niche audience. Anywho, this past weekend, I was posting photos from the Perry Pear potting. About a month ago, friends and I had collected some scion from Perry Pear trees in our spot of Ciderville. We grafted that onto rootstock, let it sit for a month in a cool temperature so it does its mind meld and the graft could hopefully take, and then we put it into soil. We did about 40 little mini trees. I did it on like a dwarf variety. I'm going to take about 5 of those trees and hopefully we'll produce some Perry Pears. And if I'm lucky, I might be able to have some scionwood for people so that somebody like out in Michigan, like Paul Vanderhyde, will be able to say, we do have Perry Pear trees in Michigan. I bet they would grow really well there. So that's my hope for the future, just palms around the world, helping each other. And certainly, I always appreciate the help that I get from the patrons of Cider Chat via the Cider Chat Patreon page, who are primarily just cider drinkers like myself, non-commercial. But then there's also some commercial makers, such as James Creek Cider in Virginia, Little Pomona in the Herefordshire region of the UK. And then there are cideries who are part of the Cider Going Up campaign, such as Current Cider of Percy, Pennsylvania, with a soon-to-be-open taproom in the Fishtown area of Philadelphia, so stay tuned for that. There is also Luxembourg's only cidery called Rambourne Cider Company, making some mighty fine ciders there out of amazing old trees, including Perry trees, too. Then there is Ross-on-Wye, based in Ross-on-Wye in the UK. There is NMR Services, based in Connecticut, which does analysis on cider. And Big Fish Cider Company, which we just had last week on episode 124. Big Fish is based in Monterey, Virginia. Well, it's starting to be apple blossom season around the Northern Hemisphere, so I hope you are enjoying it out there. This is Rio Wind Caller signing off for now. Looking forward to speaking with you next week and seeing you in Ciderville.
Going up.
Yeehaw!